You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. All this week, we've been checking in on the Republican National Convention. Prominent Wisconsinites have taken the stage all this week to rally the GOP base.
Those include House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senator Ron Johnson on Tuesday.
Only with Donald Trump and Mike Pence do we have a chance at a better way.
Donald Trump and Mike Pence understand that these must be America's top priorities. They'll be strong leaders.
And just last night, Governor Scott Walker took the stage to stump for Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump.
My fellow Americans, you have a choice. You deserve better because America deserves better.
Joining us now is WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. He's been joining us all this week from Cleveland to recap the latest from the convention and the Wisconsin delegation. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob.
Well, we've been hearing all week about what's been going on from the Wisconsin delegation. Of course, Governor Walker, as we mentioned, speaking last night. His speech and most of the speeches were eclipsed by another speaker last night. But how was Governor Walker received at the convention?
Right. Were there other speeches last night? It was Ted Cruz, right?
Ted Cruz got a lot of attention. We'll talk about that some, too.
Yeah. So Governor Walker spoke for about 10 minutes. He was not exactly in the thick of prime time there. But kind of an animated speech from the governor is reminiscent of a speech he gave to that effectively kicked off his campaign in Iowa last year, long, long time ago. But, yeah, you know, he hit some basic points over and over again. A few compliments in there for Donald Trump. A lot of criticism of Hillary Clinton. Here's a little sample of his speech last night.
The simple truth is liberal Washington insiders created our problems. And Hillary Clinton is the ultimate liberal Washington insider. If she were any more on the inside, she'd be in prison. America deserves better than Hillary Clinton. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why we need to support Donald Trump and Mike Pence to be the next president and vice president of the United States.
So the tone there, not the sort of tone you often hear from Scott Walker speaking here in Wisconsin.
No, he was a little hoarse this morning, actually, possibly because of that speech. And it was pretty much consistently loud like that and animated throughout the entire 10 minutes. You know, I don't know if he's looking to kind of project an image that people think he lacks. He wants to dispel this notion that he's a low energy governor or what, but he definitely was high energy through the speech, and he kept repeating that refrain throughout the speech that America deserves better, trying to get the audience involved with that too.
In just a bit, we're going to focus in more with another guest on Governor Walker's possible future presidential aspirations. Is that something people in the Wisconsin delegation are talking about, Sean?
You know, he's making it hard not to talk about it. When you visit the Iowa delegation, the South Carolina delegation, and the New Hampshire delegation all during his week at the Republican National Convention, I mean, those are the first presidential states. And, it obviously invites speculation that he's considering running for president, if not in 2020, maybe on down the line. He downplays that. But it's not like he completely rules it out. And, you know, when you pick those states, it's pretty strong signal that he's interested.
Talking to Sean Johnson from WPR. He's at the Republican convention in Cleveland. We mentioned that Ted Cruz speech last night, Sean, the big highlight, not so much what he did say, but what he didn't say. He didn't say vote for Donald Trump at any point during his speech. A lot of people angry about that. What was the Wisconsin delegation saying this morning, maybe over breakfast?
So it was Walker again this morning, and one of the things that the governor pointed out was that about a year ago when they had their first presidential debate in Cleveland, they stood on a stage together, at the time the top 10 candidates, of which Walker was one of them, Ted Cruz was another, and they all took a pledge that they would support the GOP nominee. He brought that pledge up again as he talked about why he's supporting Donald Trump. And he was asked about that.
Ted Cruz signed the same pledge you did. Did he do the wrong thing last night?
Well, again, to me, that'll be left up to the voters and particularly delegates to respond. I'll let him, between now and November, justify his position. But I think, not just for a pledge. I mean, let's be clear. The reason I stood on this stage wasn't just because I made a pledge. It was because I meant what I said. And I think people have to look closely at it. I meant back then, not just that I would say I'd be a part of unity. You heard me say it in there. Party unity is great, but for me it's far greater than that. I believed then, with 17 candidates in the race, that any of the Republicans running would be far greater than Hillary Clinton. I still believe that today. I don't necessarily agree with everything that Donald Trump has said. I don't necessarily agree with everything he has done along the campaign trail, but I today still fundamentally believe that he is better for this country than Hillary Clinton.
So I hear him saying he will endorse, or he does still endorse, Donald Trump. I don't hear him criticizing Ted Cruz either, at least in that that minute or so.
You know, not too much right there. He did a little bit later, to some degree, with conservative talk radio show host Charlie Sykes. But no, he went pretty easy there on Ted Cruz, especially considering what some other people were saying about him, even in his own delegation in Texas today. He's letting other people kind of do the attacks on this one. It's not typically Walker's style to mix it up in that way.
Was Ted Cruz's speech the talk of the morning at the convention from people you were talking to?
Yeah, it pretty much dominates everything. I mean, the entire idea behind this week is that we've had this divided primary. Republicans have had this especially divided primary. And they're going to come together, and they're going to come out unified. And in some ways, they have been. I mean, when you hear Scott Walker, who wouldn't even say Donald Trump's name a few weeks ago, now saying that Donald Trump would make a good president in a speech on a national stage, that's significant. When Paul Ryan is out there saying we need Donald Trump to enact our agenda, that's significant. When Ron Johnson is out there, a vulnerable Republican senator, in a public way saying we need to elect Donald Trump, that's significant. But it all kind of unravels when you have Ted Cruz out there, the guy who came in second in this messy nominating process, saying vote your conscience. That's going to get a lot more attention. And last night it even overshadowed Mike Pence, the vice presidential nominee.
I was just looking back at Scott Walker's speech announcing that he was dropping out of the presidential race. And the main reason he said he was doing it was so that people could unite around one person to stand up and defeat the front runner. The front runner was Donald Trump. This is a big change from the language we were hearing back then.
It's a big change for a lot of Republicans. I mean, you look at Paul Ryan. He's been very critical of Donald Trump on a number of occasions, saying that it sort of fits the definition of racism when you go after a judge. This is a judge that's overseeing a lawsuit involving Donald Trump, going after that judge and saying that he can't be fair because he has Mexican parents. Paul Ryan then turned around and endorsed Donald Trump. So there's a lot of Republicans who have come out and said we don't like Donald Trump, who are now coming around and saying he's better than Hillary Clinton. So we're going to support him in the name of the party.
The Wisconsin parade is not done at the Republican National Convention. I understand Reince Priebus, head of the Republican Party, nationally, formerly of the Wisconsin Republican Party, supposed to talk tonight. This campaign has given him headaches along the way, I'm sure. Are people talking about what he's going to say, or are all eyes on Donald Trump tonight?
Yeah, I think all eyes are on Donald Trump tonight. What he says is going to perhaps leave the lasting memory of the convention. He wants to project somebody who looks presidential. This is the one brief comment we got from Reince Priebus basically before we were ushered out of the Wisconsin delegation breakfast this morning. Reince Priebus was there to speak to delegates. He wants to project an image. He wants Donald Trump to project an image of somebody that people can see being president. So that could mean potentially a lower key speech from Donald Trump than you heard maybe on the in the primary campaign as Trump pivots now to the general election.
And one thing people have been watching for at this convention is this sign that the party leadership and Donald Trump can really work together and create a consistent message. Overall, vibe-wise, Sean, and I know this is kind of a gray area to try to evaluate, but do you think that we're seeing a consistent message from both parties, the party and their candidate?
It just doesn't feel like a very consistent message this week, you know, let alone something that's going to stretch out over a campaign. So I'm not sure that they're there yet. They're consistent in the degree that they say that we need to defeat Hillary Clinton. They're consistent on one of the reasons why they all come back to we need to prevent her from nominating Supreme Court justices, because especially if she nominates young justices, they could be around for 30, 40 years. It could be, you know, generations before Republicans see Supreme Court decisions that they like. So they're consistent in that way. But if you look at what's gone on this week at convention, a floor fight over the rules, shouting matches on the floor, Ted Cruz saying vote your conscience, they're not quite there yet.
Sean, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date all week.
You're welcome.
That's Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, joining us from Cleveland and the Republican National Convention.
Cities like Seattle, Austin, and San Francisco are well-known technology hubs around the country, but could we see one cropping up here in Wisconsin?
Our next guest thinks so, and it might not be in the biggest places, the biggest cities, places like Madison or Milwaukee.
After attending a recent conference on entrepreneurship, he thinks the city of Beloit could be an emerging technology hub in Wisconsin.
Matt Cordio joins us for more on that. He's the founder of Skills Pipeline and Startup Milwaukee. He also follows the latest trends in entrepreneurship, technology, and talent from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's OnRamp Labs blog. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you came in kind of with an outsider's view of Beloit here at a conference, I think it was. What caught your eye about Beloit being an emerging area for potential technology startups?
Yeah, so I think Wisconsin as a whole has a bunch of different technology hubs emerging. And I was at the Wisconsin's Entrepreneurship Conference in June, hosted by the Wisconsin Technology Council, and got the opportunity to meet an entrepreneur. Her name is Carrie Frank. She's the co-founder of a company called Comply 365, which develops software for mainly the airline industry, automating some of their checklist processes. And she was just raving about recently moving her company from Northern Illinois to Beloit, Wisconsin. And definitely thought I should go down there and check out what's growing there. You know, as a founder of Startup Milwaukee, I'm always interested in seeing what's happening in these emerging communities. So took a trip down there recently and found some stuff out.
So what kind of things did you find out on your visit there?
So, you know, the community is really growing, and a lot of that is due in part to the investment of the Hendricks Commercial Property Group. You may know Ken and Diane Hendricks as the founders of ABC Supply Co., which is one of the largest roofing supply companies in kind of the country, it seems. And they have invested in this old factory and developed what they call the Ironworks campus, where Comply 365 is, as well as a co-working space called Iron Tech and a couple other tech companies, Rakuten, which is a Japanese e-commerce company, as well as Aculynx, which is a construction project management company.
And for future potential, let's talk geography a little bit here. What is it about being in Beloit and that area that might be a benefit to those companies you just mentioned and future either startups or transplants?
So it's uniquely positioned near Northern Illinois, where a lot of technology talent could either go downtown Chicago or come towards Rockford or Beloit, and you know, also being near an international airport like O'Hare is also an asset. I think they also have a really great downtown. So I got the opportunity to walk around downtown and check out Farm to Table Cafe there, and got to see kind of the campus of Beloit College, which is a liberal arts school pumping out a lot of creative talent, and they even have an entrepreneurship program called Celeb, which I think could be a, you know, feeder into the local entrepreneurial community.
We're talking to Matt Cordio. He's the founder of Skills Pipeline and Startup Milwaukee. He writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's OnRamp Labs blog, and we're looking at what he says could be an emerging technology hub, a big potential zone for technology growth in Wisconsin, the city of Beloit and the region around it. He's looking at some companies there and the prospects for the future. Matt, I think somebody might look at a city the size of Beloit and say, it's great they've got good things going on there, but it maybe isn't big enough to have that critical mass you would need in a place to really have technology companies take off. Do you think that potential is there despite the size?
Yes. I think there is a lot of population within the range. Obviously, it's somewhat constrained long term. But, I think that smaller towns, you see a lot of technology clustering up in the Wausau-Stevens Point area as well. That's maybe not one of the largest, population bases in Wisconsin. But these smaller cities can attract talent when they have great companies in them.
Let's talk about collaboration. You mentioned Beloit College. You mentioned the Ironworks thing. Is there a public effort there? Is the city, maybe county, state leadership getting involved in what's going on in Beloit?
So Comply 365's founder, Carrie Frank, when she was talking about her story of moving to Wisconsin, she actually received a phone call directly from the governor, and she tasked him with some various assignments, some information to get from him, and he got back to her, and she made the decision that Wisconsin's business climate was attractive, more attractive maybe than Illinois, and moved on up to Beloit.
Do you see that leadership at a local level too, or is that an important part of the picture?
Yeah, local level, I'm not sure. The Chamber of Commerce, I know, is housed in the Iron Tech co-working space. So it seems like there is some collaboration there.
So let's talk more generally, stepping outside of Beloit. A lot of communities, big and small, are hoping to tap into some kind of high-tech industry, maybe be the next new hub for startups. What do you think is make or break for a community? What are some of the secret ingredients that they need to pursue?
So some of the more successful entrepreneurial communities that I see emerging in Wisconsin are really, those communities are being developed by entrepreneurs investing back in their own community after achieving an exit from their startup or success in their entrepreneurial careers. They're actually investing in the technology companies that are emerging and kind of ushering in this third wave of technology. Cities like Madison, you see successful entrepreneurs starting venture funds. Similar in Beloit, you see Diane Hendricks playing an active role in growing the entrepreneurial community there. Another important aspect of these emerging communities are co-working spaces, like the Iron Tech space in Beloit, which kind of gives entrepreneurs some office space and connectivity to other entrepreneurs that are in the community. You see that in Milwaukee at Ward 4, located in the Third Ward, which was financed by Chris Abley. You see that in Madison, entrepreneurs have built this 100-state space where they can collaborate, as well as they have a larger vision to start up a space called Starting Block, which is financed by American Family Insurance and other corporate players that are giving back to the community. So, those are kind of the key ingredients, entrepreneurs investing and paying it forward in the communities that they're from, as well as just kind of having spaces and programs to connect each other in the community.
Matt, I want to get your take on an issue we've heard about a lot in the state over the last couple of years, the idea that there's a skills gap, that modern manufacturing needs highly trained, highly educated workers with good technical skills. High-tech startups obviously are going to need things like that. Do you see that skills gap in Wisconsin, and do you see solid efforts to turn that around?
I'm not as familiar with the manufacturing space as I am the tech space. I think that we do have a history of producing some great technology talent, whether it's, out of UW-Madison or MSOE in Milwaukee, Marquette University, UWM all have great software engineering programs. The key is retaining that talent here in Wisconsin after they graduate. I'm a Marquette University alum, and a lot of my colleagues ended up moving down to the Chicago area or out to the coasts when they got their engineering degrees. So how do we keep that talent in Wisconsin? And a lot of it has to do with kind of the maybe not measurable aspect of building communities where people want to live, whether that's, you know, unique amenities like great restaurants, great culture, but it also is building great companies. So those are kind of, that's kind of, I think, what could move the needle in Wisconsin is really focusing on retaining the college students that we have here. There are programs like the Commons and the Milwaukee area, which I was involved with starting, that are actually exposing students to local companies that are doing innovative things, as well as helping students start their own companies. And I think the more that we do that, the more that we get young talent ingrained here in Wisconsin, the better.
Now, whether we're talking about Beloit or Milwaukee or elsewhere in the state, are you big picture optimistic about the future for high technology startups in the state?
Yes. You know, I think that Wisconsin needs to focus more on the fact that there are a lot of technology companies here. You know, we've traditionally been a, you know, I think kind of focused on manufacturing, food and beverage processing, as well as agriculture. And, you know, the truth is all those companies have the potential to be enabled by technology. So let's talk more about that. And, you know, glad that, you know, you've had me on to kind of talk about the importance of tech in the future of Wisconsin's economy.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to entrepreneur and tech blogger Matt Cordio, making the case for Beloit and some other communities as emerging technology hubs around Wisconsin. It wasn't all that long ago that Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker ended his short run for the White House.
Today, I believe that I'm being called to lead by helping to clear the field in this race so that a positive conservative message can rise to the top of the field. With this in mind, I will suspend my campaign immediately.
Governor Walker is attending the Republican National Convention this week in Cleveland and was one of the featured speakers last night.
He's also been using the gathering as an opportunity to get reacquainted with delegations from key primary states, as well as the GOP party movers and shakers. That may indicate, some say, he's ramping up for another run for the White House, maybe 2020, maybe 2024.
Matthew DeFoor joins us now. He covers state government for the Wisconsin State Journal and has been writing about what Governor Walker's recent activities might mean. Matt, good to have you back with us.
Veronica, thanks for having me.
So you're there at the GOP convention in Cleveland. What evidence do you see that Governor Walker is laying the groundwork for another presidential run in 2020?
Well, it's obviously still very early. We haven't even gotten done with this presidential election yet. We're just nominating the candidates. But Governor Walker on Monday was visiting with the Iowa delegation. They, have, of course, hold the first in a caucus contest. They did this year, and they'll be doing it in 2020, 2024, 2036. And the governor visited with South Carolina yesterday, and I was able to go to that. And, there's a video on Madison.com. You can watch his speech. And I was talking with the South Carolina chairman, GOP chairman. He was, you know, explaining that in 2012, Marco Rubio and Chris Christie at the RNC were doing these kinds of breakfasts. They were establishing that relationship with, you know, people in other states, and obviously these early voting states are crucial in the nominating process. Donald Trump, of course, wasn't, so I kind of joked with him about that, but, you know, we've talked to others who say that these kinds of visits are very important if you're going to lay the groundwork for a future presidential run. Doesn't mean you're going to do it, but it certainly is a hint that you haven't stopped thinking about it.
Well, and as you said, he spoke yesterday at this delegation breakfast. What was the tone? What kinds of things did he say?
You know, there are a lot of echoes of when he was on the campaign trail last year, and even before he was on the campaign trail. He's establishing a rapport. He's telling stories about, you know, flipping hamburgers in Delavan, and you know, he tells a joke about Paul Ryan being told by his manager that, you know, he didn't have the interpersonal skills to work the cash register, and, you know, is able to add on the addendum that he, you know, he would wonder what the manager was thinking when he saw Paul Ryan at the, you know, at the State of the Union address sitting behind the president. So, you know, he's doing that same kind of shtick where he is, you know, endearing himself to these party leaders in other states, and, you know, of course, he's a delegate with the Wisconsin delegation, but he's making the rounds.
It's interesting, going into this race, he was seen as a rising star. He was topping a national poll at one point, even, and of course here in Wisconsin as well, just for a little bit before he kind of flamed out early on. But I wonder how he's perceived now. He wasn't an advocate of Trump early on. In fact, kind of the opposite. So how do people see him there at the convention?
From what I can tell, he's definitely got a following. People definitely like him. He's made some good relationships. I get the sense that, you know, he certainly has the potential. You know, a lot of people are critical of he was this rising star, like you said, but just kind of he ended up falling flat on the presidential trail, and that might have been the sign of inexperience. I know former Governor Tommy Thompson had said previously that he doesn't think Walker will be able to do it again. That it's hard enough running once. You know, I sat down with Tommy today, and he was suggesting that it might not be impossible, but I also got the impression that he thinks a lot more highly of Paul Ryan possibly running in the future. So,
and hearing about what Governor Walker himself has said, you said he sounded a little bit like he was using at least the same verbiage that he did when he was running earlier. But has he tipped his hand at all and said, "Yeah, I am thinking"?
What he did say is that, which I thought was a little bit of a tell, was that he could run in 20 years and still be younger than Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump are now. And so he's, I think he's turning 48 this year. And so, that it certainly creates the impression that he has not stopped thinking about it or ruled it out. And so that's, I think, what we can say from what he's been saying. But he's obviously not. Completely showing his cards at this point because he's still got to run potentially for re-election in 2018, and his run for president, his run for president, is maybe one of the reasons why his poll numbers in Wisconsin have fallen below 40%.
Well, and he's there ostensibly right to support Donald Trump, the candidate, but that's not a role that he's embraced. In this entire journey, there was Wisconsin, in fact, did not go for Donald Trump in the primary, and Scott Walker at one point was saying to his fellow candidates in the GOP field, you should drop out so that we can get an alternative to Trump. So how is he perceived in that phalanx of Trump backers?
He's trying to thread the needle here because he recognizes that there is obviously huge support for Donald Trump among the Republican base. He doesn't want to alienate them by seeming to be offended too much by Trump or to be against him. And he also wants to make sure he's still seen as credible among the establishment who have held their noses or completely rejected Trump. And some of them are, some of the big names of the party aren't even here. So you get the sense that he's trying to balance those things. How successfully he's doing it, remains to be seen.
So how full-throated would you say his support of Donald Trump is while he's there? Has he completely turned that corner and become a robust supporter, or is he still hanging back a little?
I think so. I mean, he didn't mention Trump's name, I don't believe, at the state convention, but he's talking about Trump. It's for him, it's obviously very much, we can't elect Hillary Clinton. With Paul Ryan as Speaker of the House, I think there's this feeling that Trump, they can maybe control him in some sense, so they have some ability to influence the outcome of things. And so if there's concerns about other, his leadership style or things he says, they really just sort of brush past all of that because of this sort of, this real intense animus toward Hillary Clinton and the President Obama administration. That seems to be a real motivating factor for a lot of Republicans who've come around.
We're talking to Matt DeFore right now, State Capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He's covering the GOP convention in Cleveland, where he joins us from a restaurant. We're talking about the political future of Governor Scott Walker. And curious about what the future would be like with a President Donald Trump. I imagine it's a different future potentially based on who wins. So let's say for the moment that Donald Trump is the next president. What does Scott Walker's future then look like?
We might have different opinions on this, but there is this idea of a Trump victory in November could have the sort of impact that George Bush's victory had in 2000, although there are a lot of national event, or international events going on in that period, including the war, that, again, in 2002 is when Governor Jim Doyle was elected for the first time. So if Trump's in office, it seems like it might help the Democrats in 2018. And, you know, in that situation, if Walker's approval numbers are still low, or you know, does that influence the decision? I mean, it's hard to say for sure. But if Hillary wins, you know, you almost wonder if that, again, 2010 was the Tea Party wave year after Barack Obama got elected. Could we see something like that in 2018 again, just because people are continuing to sort of you know, be anti-establishment and not like the policies of the Democratic administration? You know, and does that create a reason for Walker to stick around and run again and maybe help his chances? I think those are the ideas out there. It's really very early to know.
Well, and as you said, Trump is an anti-establishment candidate. So if Donald Trump does win the presidency, do people then look at someone like Scott Walker, who is an establishment Republican, and say people didn't want that? That's why we voted for Donald Trump. And then you're looking for candidates who come more from the outside.
It's possible that that's what ended up hurting him in the presidential. If they're in a situation where Trump gets beaten pretty badly, you know, they may pull back from being completely anti-establishment. They may give another look at sort of the conservative figures, who, you know, people like Paul Ryan, you know, who I think share a lot of those conservative views. But, you know, again, we also don't know if it's just a matter of the people who are nominating Trump not being really dyed-in-the-wool conservatives. But, yeah, you know, we'll see what happens with Walker in the future.
And you pointed out that he's still got another election as governor to win if he wants to stay in a position of power. How does that affect how he's seen on the national stage? If he loses, for instance, his seat as governor here in Wisconsin, what happens to his chance on the national stage?
Yeah, I mean, as we've seen with other potential contenders, is once they get out of elected office, it is a little bit harder. If he loses, if he was worried about losing, I don't think he would run. It would seem like if you see him running, he's got a pretty good indication that he's going to be able to win again. I think a loss would certainly be a blow to a future presidential run. And again, he's also got to contend with Paul Ryan as the House Speaker from Wisconsin, who's in a tough position himself, but, you know, his poise and his, you know, leadership in the House might be viewed as, you know, the antidote to Donald Trump should they get beaten badly in November.
What is Scott Walker's relationship like with Paul Ryan?
Oh, I think they're very close. I'm not that close to either of them to be able to, you know, gauge how this, you know, this whole question of which one of them runs would play out. It would be. Surprising. I've talked to some people that it'd be surprising if they both ran. Yeah. Who knows?
And right now, Wisconsin is particularly well represented in the Republican Party's upper echelons, as you said, with House Speaker Paul Ryan and Republican National Chairman Reince Priebus. Does that help Walker in where he is, or is there a sense that Wisconsin is kind of saturated?
So Reince Priebus being the chairman of the party, I think the impact we've seen of that is he has been really reaching out to Paul Ryan and Scott Walker and Ron Johnson, for that matter, to get them on board with Trump, to really quash that anti-Trump movement out there. You know, if you'll recall that some of the people in the anti-Trump Free the Delegates movement were actually calling up Scott Walker, trying to recruit him as a leader. And he, I don't think he tamped that down entirely at first, but he has since, you know, basically sided with Donald Trump, and in doing so, I think he's been siding with Reince Priebus.
Now, going back to Scott Walker's talk at the delegation breakfast, some of the highlights I understand that he talked about Wisconsin's record with concealed carry and curbing the collective bargaining among public sector unions. How does that go over with the people he's talking to?
In the people in Wisconsin, you said, or the people in the...
People there at the convention, at the breakfast in particular.
Yeah, you hear, I mean, when he brings up those stories, you do hear that smattering of applause. Although I would point out that when he during his presidential campaign, 71 days, one of the shortest in recent history, he came out with a policy position to, you know, essentially do the same thing at the federal level, which doesn't have nearly the same level of union strength as Wisconsin's public sector unions did prior to 2011. And that policy, you know, statement fell flat. There was no real rallying in any, you know, sense around that idea that catapulted him into any more of the spotlight than Donald Trump had already occupied. And a week later, he dropped out of the race. So, you know, Wisconsin was an anomaly this year in being a state that really resisted Donald Trump. And I think another respect, there may be an anomaly in some of the ways we've had our politics play out in the last 5 or 6 years.
And Matt, as we wrap up, we talked about how Scott Walker dropped out of the race early after some pretty high hopes were pinned on him. Are you hearing any theories about why that happened and how he might pivot and change what happens if there's a run in his future?
Well, he dropped out because he ran out of money. He had a lot of money in his super PAC, but it was sort of the first real election cycle in the presidential election cycle where the super PAC was sort of being touted as the thing that could really change the game. But, you know, again, super PACs cannot coordinate with the campaigns. And so he was running out of money because he needed staff. He needed, I don't know if he needed it, but he built it out too quickly. And so that's probably a big lesson he learned. Some person I talked to mentioned how Rick Wiley, his campaign manager, was maybe not the best choice because he's more of a an infrastructure kind of guy and getting those infrastructure built up in the state, but he's not necessarily a political strategist, somebody who would be able to recognize that this was going to be a long-haul kind of primary fight and that they needed to conserve resources. I think that maybe people advising Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio better recognize.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us.
Veronica, it was great to be with you.
That was Matt DeFore. He covers state government for the Wisconsin State Journal. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. We were thinking about the first news stories we remember in our lives, and we're interested to hear from you with your first news memory. Call in now at 800-642-1234. Tell us the story and maybe what you remember about when you first heard about it or what that meant at that time of your life. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. While you're calling in, here are some of the sounds from, you know, a few of the different generations of big news stories.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot outside a Memphis motel this afternoon. His condition is not known at this time.
We have a breaking news story to tell you about. Apparently, a plane has just crashed into the World Trade Center here in New York City. It happened just a few moments ago, apparently. We have very little information available.
Some of the more traumatic news stories there, of course. You might have happy memories as well. Let's go to our callers now with your first remembered news stories. We've got Jim on the line in Waukesha. Jim, hi. Jim, are you there?
You hear me?
Yeah, what's your first news story, Jim?
Well, it was October 12th, 1948. A truly momentous day. I was in, well, it's an echo of what's happening. I was in downtown Cleveland on the public square. I was 5 years old. I was on my father's shoulder. And the greatest thing that had happened in a long, long time was that the Cleveland Indians had beaten the Braves in the World Series.
How old were you, Jim?
Five.
5 years old, and that's your memory. Jim, thank you so much for that. Yeah, a lot of people might have a sports memory as one of their first ones. A lot of space memories we heard. We surveyed some of our colleagues. Dave, one of our colleagues here, said when Alan Shepard went in and orbited up in space, or his first space flight, the moon landing, of course. Now we're going to some more of your memories of your first news story. I'll go to Mark in Eau Claire now. Mark, hi.
Hello. I remember sitting with the family in my grandmother's house watching the Kennedy-Nixon debates in 1960, fall of 1960. I was 5 years old.
5 years old. Do you remember what you thought about that or kind of the circumstance surrounding it?
I don't, maybe it was my relatives, but I took immediate liking to Richard Nixon.
All right. And do you remember actually just watching those on the TV? That was a big TV moment in history.
Yeah, big. We were all fixated on the TV. Everybody was commenting, and it was an important time. I knew that.
Mark, thanks so much for the call. I seem to remember polls at the time saying Nixon had won among people who listened on the radio. Kennedy had won among people who won the debate among people who watched on TV, but not for Mark's family, it sounds like. We'll go next to Ian in Stevens Point. Ian, hi.
Hi, Rob.
What's your memory, Ian?
I will never forget in 2008, I was in eighth grade, and I remember standing in my living room with my mom and dad, and Barack Obama won the 2008 November election, and I remember thinking to myself that this is a memory I'm going to hold for a long time, and it's going to really stick out for a while for me when that happened, and I really felt like something was happening and changing in our country.
Ian, I'm not sure how old you were at that time. Eighth grade, I think you said. Was this? Did you get to stay up past the bedtime to watch the election returns come in?
It was a weeknight, and it was a little late, and I had finished up my homework, but I definitely remember staying up late with mom and dad, and I had to have been 12 or 13 at that point, and that was definitely a memory that I'll cherish for a long time.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Ian. I know exactly where I was then. It was on the other side of the glass here because I was directing our election night coverage. That one's not too hard to remember. We'll go next to Adam on the line in Appleton. Adam, hi.
Hi.
What's your memory?
I'm probably about 12 years old, and we were taking a family trip to Great America in Chicago, Illinois. And we were watching a rerun of some show when they broke in to announce that Princess Diana had died.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And there was then in that car crash, and my initial reaction was not a big one, but my mother was horrified, and she woke up my father who was sleeping, and told him, and his reaction was extreme as well. And I remember thinking, wow, this is a big deal, and that's the first thing I remember.
Thank you, Adam. That was a big one that really caught a lot of people's attention that year. I will go next to Tim on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Tim, hi.
Hi. I think my first recollection, I was born in 61, and the Vietnam War was just on the news every night. And every night they showed the number of servicemen died that day, every day.
Thank you so much for that, Tim. One of our colleagues here had mentioned that as one of his first memories, the annual death counts of the Vietnam War. Keep sharing your first news memories over at the Central Time Facebook page.